have quite a few people who've signed up to provide us with testimony in our second item. And I always am so appreciative. We, as the commission, are always so appreciative to see citizens come out and brave the front table, give us their testimony. It might be scary, but we do really want to hear what you have to say. Important issues are always brought to our attention this way. So I'll call you up two at a time, and then about midway through, we've got a panel from the Quileute tribe who would like to bring an issue to our attention, so we'll call them up all at once. But we'll start with Bruce Beattie and Jim Franklin, if you would come forward. You're allowed 3 minutes each. When you hear the beeping noise, that means your time is up. And we'd like you to conclude your remarks. Sometimes people get so involved in their presentation that they can't hear the beeping noise. So if that happens, I'll just politely interrupt you and let you know that your time is up. Mr. Beattie, welcome back.
Nice to be here. My name is Bruce Beattie from University Place, Washington. This brief address to you is likely to be my last. I have nothing more to add. You and your agency have received for 13 years subject matter, peer-reviewed science, and has been presented especially for the latest Golden Fish pamphlet rewrite. It's our opinion as miners that the agency has never presented any evidence or scientific journals or work that will counter what is in this book. This book has 30 research papers in it. This book is used in the court cases all up and down the West Coast. We feel that the agency has only used conjecture in formulating the rules in the Golden Fish pamphlet. Since we are all pretty much familiar with the mining law, let's look at the Multiple Use Act, 30 U.S.C. 612A. Any mining claim hereafter shall not be used for any purposes other than mining or processing operations and uses reasonably incident thereto. 30 U.S.C. 612B, the statute does give the United States the right to manage and dispose vegetative surface resources and other resources except mineral deposits subject to the location under the mining laws. Further, in B, that any use of the surface of any such mining claim by the United States, its permittees and licensees shall be such as not to endanger or materially interfere with prospecting, mining, or processing operations or uses reasonably incident thereto. In FLTMA, 1976, Federal Lands Policy and Management Act. What Congress states in FLTMA, no provisions in this section or any other section of the Act shall in any way amend the mining law of 1872 or impair the rights of any locators or claims under that Act, including but not limited to rights of ingress or egress. It's my hope that the agency will take this information to the legislature at the appropriate time when there are bills present, because they need to do their fiduciary duty and let them know what the law is on the federally managed lands where our federally managed mining claims are. Last but not least, Ron Wilson could not make it. His wife's in the hospital with a heart infection. He wanted to give this to you. I only have one copy. Thank you very much.
Yeah, give that to Tammy and she'll circulate it. Thank you.
In 13 years, I never had a question asked of me. Do you have one? Straightforward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Cunningham, would you come forward?
Okay, my name is Jim Franklin. Not much of a public speaker, but I'm going to try. I'm an old gold miner. I've been dredging for probably 30 years. Anyway, it was my pleasure to work with Mr. Chapman up on the Smilkameen River. I was my old buddy and I was doing the dredging for the mussel study. And after we did this, everything was fine. And we came to the conclusion that we really didn't have any impact at all on anything as far as mussels or fish or anything else. But needless to say, it seems like they're trying to shut us out of the water. Now, I've got three grandkids that I would like to get into gold mining. They're starting, but they're still a little bit too young. But it looks to me like when they get old enough to go out on their own gold dredges, there's not going to be anything to do because of the fish situations and this kind of thing. I'm also a steelhead fisherman. I go down to the river, and the best fish to catch is a female steelhead. Best eaten, best there is. Of course, I'm killing about 100,000 eggs when I kill a steelhead out of that river. Now, down below me, there's probably 20, 30 gillnets down there gillnetting that are killing anywhere from probably 100 to 200 fish a day. They aren't going anything between male and female. So I'm killing 100,000 eggs a day, but if I only get one, they're killing how many millions of eggs down there during the gravel bar. And all the time that I've been dredging, I have never dredged up any fish eggs at all. We don't dredge out in the shallow river banks or out into the shallow gravel bars. We want to get down where the big rocks, all the overburden is real compacted in there. That's where the gold's going to be at. And so anyway, I think, you know, this fish situation is far beyond us. I think it's something to do with all the netting that's being done downriver, out in the ocean, anywhere like that. I mean, we don't kill any fish. And, you know, we're all gold miners, and we just don't do that. So anyway, that's my statement.
Thank you. William Thomas, would you please come forward? Mr. Cunningham, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Commissioners, I had a packet that I printed out for each one of you, but I don't see it on your desks anywhere. It does contain some pictures in it that I wish you would pay some attention to, and I hope I'm not going to attempt to read the darn thing to you. It's not very long, but I would appreciate it if you would read it. And what I'm speaking of is under the Washington State Constitution, Section 12 of Special Privileges, you're not allowed to do that. And what your department is in the process of doing is creating classes of people. And you're specifically not allowed to create different classes of people. And in that packet, you'll find these pictures. And these pictures are permits required on the beach. This is in the same area, and no permit required. I can do this on the beach. I can have a fire. I can pick up driftwood. If I apply for a permit to do prospecting, I can't do that. And it's real. It's a $5,000 fine or a year in jail. And that's two classes of people. And it's something that the Constitution doesn't allow. And Parks, between WDFW and Parks, you've come up with a permit system to do it on the beaches. And the legislature in 1997 specifically said that small-scale mining and prospecting shall not require a permit. So you're breaking the Constitution, you're breaking the legislative law, and somebody's going to have to fix it at some point in time. The legislature can do it, you can do it, or the courts can do it. But you're not allowed. It's under Section 12 of the Constitution. Special privileges and immunities are specifically prohibited, and you're doing it. And there was a conflict between Parks and WDFW, and both departments knew it, and you passed it anyway. So I'll hold it. And please, it's very short, but pay attention to the pictures, what's allowed and what's not allowed, and if you get a permit, you're not allowed to do what all these people are doing freely right next to each other. Thank you.
Thank you. Scott Atkinson, please come forward.
Good morning, Chair Wecker and rest of the commissioners. Really quick, I've provided a handout for everybody to read. A lot of to offer a different perspective to the HPA brief you're going to get from the department. The regulations, we wrote a set of rules. Those rules are then combined with other pertinent information as to who might possibly have some idea of mineral prospecting. Then they put in some terminology, put in the rules and regurgitate them, and put out a Golden Fish pamphlet. Sections, the last two sections of this Golden Fish pamphlet act as a permit. They're for the motorized equipment. The first section deals with everything with the legislative authorized equipment, pans, mini rocker boxes, so forth. And there's no timing restrictions. That's what they how they got broke up. So here we have a conflict where back in 2011, the beach mining laws from Parks got passed. There's provisions in rule that says that mineral prospect, you may mineral prospect all through the time except on lakes and ocean beaches, which violates, that statement by itself violates statute that says mineral prospecting does not need a permit. So instead of fixing it once Parks passed the law, they decided that, oh, we're going to make an HPA. So now we have another application so that we can do what's allowed. Of all these permits, we found out that the timing windows are a problem. The agency knows that they're a problem. There's proposals now as part of this draft package to change those timing windows, even though they're not negotiable, is what we were told during the whole thing. You guys were informed by the following day of our public testimony back in 2008 how those timing windows were a problem. You heard from the sports fish guy how they were a problem. The model was wrong, and they went ahead and adopted them anyway. So here we are, years later. People are still complaining about them. There's only one probable way to fix that. And I've submitted a petition for adoption to have those timing windows repealed. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we'll have to look at the petition when it comes in. We're required to respond to those petitions, so
every single one of you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Steve Gackey, would you come forward, please? We'll carry on this discussion in the future.
Good morning, Commissioners, and Happy New Year. Being that I live down in the southern part of the state, we don't have the effect that you guys are seeing with that number 12 up here in the Seattle area. We all huddle around the TV and watch the favorite Northwest team. I see some new faces today. It's been a while since I testified. I'm Scott Atkinson. I'm the former president of Northwest Mineral Prospectors. I'm a stream steward. I'm a member of Northwest Steelheaders in Vancouver. And I'm concerned. I've got six items here. I'll go through them really quickly, and if you guys have any questions, please ask. As I watched from the sidelines on this last HCP and the HPA development, I noticed that the agency did not follow the legislative instruction to include the miners in the planning and development, which we did in 2007 to 2009 during the development of the Golden Fish pamphlet. I started prospecting in 2006. I learned how to pan at the Sportsman Show down in Portland. I'd never panned before. A year later, I'm involved in developing a set of regulations for the state of Washington. I am a former member of Trout Unlimited. I was involved in their projects up in the Puget Sound. The politics dealing with the agency and all the other issues we had with the sport fishing and commercial fishing priorities and preferences. So it concerned me that this last go-around that the agency did not ask the miners to participate. in a intensive way so that we wouldn't have to be here today to discuss all this stuff. Number two is a review of the presented papers fails to show minors' comments. I noticed that the Lumi comments are specified, but there's no points for the mining community's comments and issues. Number three is the agency resurrected white papers in development of the HCP and the HPA changes. We found during the Golden Fish pamphlet development that the white papers that Fish and Wildlife created, resurrected, or whatever, were flawed. They've been found flawed in the court cases that Bruce has been dealing with. The agency took the draft. That's fast.
Yeah. You've got to be concise here.
Anyway, 3 minutes is never enough time.
Can you submit your...
One last question. As a commission, are you commissioned to act to protect the agency, or are you commissioned to protect the public? And I thank you for your opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. Thank you. Steve, Mr. Gackey.
Chair Wecker, commissioners, Director Anderson, and Deputy Director Storr, I am Steve Gackey from NACEL. I'm here to speak regarding Agenda Item 6, the NACEL River Rule Change. I thought I may need to clarify for the record that this rule change only affects the section from Highway 4 Bridge upstream to the Crown Mainline Salmi Bridge. The January 3rd public notice, which is on the website and in the newspapers, states on the lower NACEL River, which is not accurate, and I have received a few phone calls about shutting down the river below the Highway 4 Bridge. I would like to also add some further information regarding the comments I made at the December 6th meeting. The department received two opposition comments for the proposal, and they were loss of opportunity without scientific backing, and access for disabled anglers will be lost, and a suggestion to limit the size of motor. These concerns, as I understand them, were from individuals who are not from NACEL, and probably not familiar with the very small size of this river. Simply put, opportunity or access cannot be lost since it does not already exist. Historically, there have not been any known sightings of gas-powered motors above the Highway 4 Bridge. Due to the small size of the river, shallow riffles, which would be difficult to navigate during normal flows, but in addition, and this is a very critical piece, there is not a single authorized boat ramp within this section of river. With very concentrated bank fishery and the small size of this river, gear conflicts will continue if you choose not to take action. And we are requesting that you adopt the rule change as presented. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to call up the Tony Foster and Mel Moon and whoever else you would like to bring up to the front table. Representing the Quileute Tribe.
Good morning. Well, since we've only got 3 minutes, we better hurry. We have our full council here. We have our staff. We have our attorneys to show you how important this is to us. And so I'm going to read a letter for you folks. Okay. The Quileute Tribe, along with the Ho Tribe and the Quinault Indian Nation, are located on the Pacific coast of the Olympic Peninsula. In 1856, the United States government asked us to give up our lands, the lands upon which our ancestors lived, hunted, and fished. We signed a treaty that year, giving up our land, but we refused to give up our right to continue hunting and fishing in the same area that we always hunted and fished for generations. To our tribe, fishing and hunting were and still are critical to maintaining our cultural identity. So the treaty said we get to keep these rights. We get to continue hunting and fishing in the same areas we always had. Well, we have had our fair share of disagreements with the state of Washington regarding these treaty rights. A common goal we have always shared is preservation of our natural resources. We at Quileute often speak of preserving the animals and plants so that people can eat for seven generations to come. In recognition of our commonalities and the importance of working together to preserve these resources and honor treaty rights, the state and tribe entered into the Centennial Accord 25 years ago. The accord creates accountability between tribes and the state and assures that treaty rights will be respected through continued communication and government-to-government meetings. But in October and November of this year, DFW entered into agreements with three tribes to let those tribes come into Quileute's territory to hunt without telling Quileute or asking for Quileute's permission. The state never told Quileute that these agreements were even being negotiated in the first place. We heard about them for the first time from a WDFW enforcement officer who saw one of these tribal hunters in our area. What is just as shocking is that the state signed these agreements before it ever even heard evidence that those tribes had a right to hunt there in the first place. It is Quileute's position that there is no evidence supporting those tribes' rights to hunt our territory. We've told that to the tribes themselves on numerous occasions, but the state never asked us. The state never included us in discussions, never gave us a chance to protect our treaty rights. The state did not even inform non-tribal hunters who are also impacted because of the added pressure on the local game resources. When we heard about the agreements, we asked to participate in the state meetings with these tribes when the tribes finally did come up with some evidence. The state refused to allow it. We never seen the evidence, and the state had given it to us even though we've asked them again and again. In the meantime, these tribes are not only slaughtering animals within the territory that the state opened up for them, they are taking advantage of the state's lack of enforcement by hunting even further south and west than the agreements allow. We told the state about all of these problems with the agreements and asked the state to rescind them, but the state refused. These agreements are causing catastrophic losses of game and are violating Quileute Treaty's rights. It is absolutely unacceptable. We are here to ask you again to rescind the agreements as a last resort. Please respect our treaty rights, honor your promises under the Centennial Accord, and work with us to preserve rather than demolish our natural resources.
Thank you.
Thank you. You have any questions?
Oh, there's lots and lots of questions. I mean, you bring up some very complex issues. And so I think I'd like to hear from Mr. Moon, and then we'll try to respond.
Okay. You know, as I mentioned earlier today with you, I think this exercise is one in having to raise the awareness of what's actually happening. I know you folks have a lot of things on your plate, a lot of things that are going on, and that the commission has responsibilities over. But we're having difficulties getting an audience. We're having difficulties getting a response. And so we felt that this was going to be important to be able to speak to you people who are in touch with the resource and give an opportunity for the exchange to take place. We've had some letters go back and forth between Phil's staff and myself, but the hunting is still going on. The damages are still occurring. The due process has not happened. They've arrived. They're taking animals. It's inconsistent with any kind of plan that we've made in terms of the care for the animals that are being removed. It is a mess. So we need you to be aware. We need to provide you with the information, and we need to have this dialogue happen quite soon. And that's why we're here today.
Okay.
And that's it.
Okay. Thank you. As I've mentioned in some of my communications with you, it's a very difficult issue for the commission to engage in. Quite a few of us here have been informed, briefed, thoroughly educated on the complexities of intertribal conflicts as well as government-to-government negotiations. So I am sure at least of one thing, and that is that we can't provide a resolution right now. And I know that what you're looking for is more of a dialogue. and it may take some time. So I asked the director to be ready to provide his insights into the rationale of the department's actions to date, our perspectives on it, and then I am going to ask our executive committee of the commission to review this issue, and we'll begin this more extensive dialogue with you. Dr. Anderson?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Good morning. Well, there's been a lot. From my perspective, there's been a lot of dialogue going on between the department staff, and in particular, Mr. Moon, on this issue over the course of a number of months. I ran across a letter in my file that came from the Quileute Tribe in March of the year 2000 to Jeff Canings that was on this very specific issue. So this issue has been around a long time. We have some tribes that believe their traditional area, and you'll recall that we've got ceded areas, and there's also traditional or aboriginal areas that may extend beyond ceded area boundaries. We have a variety of perspectives from different tribal governments on the geographic scope of the treaty right to hunt. And we also, as you well know, have the Buchanan decision that came through the state Supreme Court that gives at least the state some guidance on how to deal with geographic scope. It speaks to ceded areas, it speaks to traditional areas, it speaks to what qualifies as a traditional area that includes both use and occupancy for hunting activities. Some of the tribes that were, and I'm purposely not naming specific tribes, but some of the tribes that have asserted traditional hunting areas within the Quileute or within the Quinault Treaty area, which obviously includes the Quileute ceded area, they've been opening areas within the Quinault Treaty area for a long time by regulation. As a matter of fact, they've been opening areas that it goes far beyond the geographic areas that are in our current one-year agreements that we have with the three tribes that Mr. Foster and Mr. Moon mentioned. There are some black and white things associated with geographic scope, I think, from our perspective. Does a tribe that has a ceded area in the northwest part of the state does their traditional areas extend to into Asotin County, as an example? That's probably one of the examples of a black and white issue. But there are areas which I will categorize as gray areas where tribes bring forward information to us, and really to back up a step, the issue for us is, where does state hunting regulations apply to a tribal member, and where is state law preempted as a result of that tribal member exercising his or her treaty right? And again, there are some places that's clear. In ceded areas, that's very abundantly clear. Traditional areas and the level of evidence that's required to substantiate a traditional use area is one that is not well defined, from my perspective. And so when we are, we're not, you know, there's been the use of the terms that we let them hunt in particular areas. I would submit we don't have the ability to make any determinations on to the extent of the treaty right in terms of geographically. We know in the other pieces, of course, this issue has not had nearly as much amount of case law in the federal arena in particular as the fishing right. There are several decisions that you're familiar with, the Chambers decision that largely dealt with open and unclaimed versus lands that would not be characterized as open and unclaimed. But on where the level of what is the level of evidence, and are we the ones that have to make that determination? Well, so when we think about where we're going to devote our enforcement resources, we want to devote those in areas where we have a relatively high degree of certainty that if we cite an individual for hunting illegally, that we have a reasonable opportunity to be successful in a prosecution. That obviously entails working with county prosecutors and coordinating with them. So in this instance, and we've had this issue with in a number of different places. We had this issue with the Macaw tribe. We've had this issue with the Muckleshoot tribe. We've had this issue with the Upper Skagit tribe. Not all pertaining to the QTA ceded area, but where tribes have asserted a treaty right in areas that are beyond the ceded area boundary, but are in areas which they believe meet the test of a traditional area. And we've had that issue with the Quinault Indian Nation. And in most cases, we've been able to sit down with that particular tribe, have that particular tribe provide us their perspective, rationale, justification, or regarding why they believe a particular area falls within their traditional area for that tribe. And we have reached these state tribal hunting agreements that include some uncertainty in terms of what they could expect from our enforcement officers with respect to enforcing state law on certain geographic areas. They also include a number of other features that you have been briefed on, everything from coordinating management efforts, data sharing. They have addressed issues associated with hunting on private industrial timberlands, a number of different areas which have presented challenges in the co-management realm relative to hunting. I very much appreciate what Mr. Foster, Mr. Moon, and the Quileute tribal members and council members have brought forward on this issue. I have an offer out there, and it remains there to come and meet with you on a government-to-government basis to further our discussions on this. I have indicated that we welcome any information that they might have to bring to bear on this issue. As I mentioned, these are one-year agreements, and we're wide open and to meeting with the Quileute tribe or any other tribe that has a particular concern with one of our agreements. I've met with the Yakima Nation relative to the Muckleshoot one. The Quileute tribe and I have met on the Macaw piece. I can't remember how many years ago that was, but it was four years ago. But I would also say that there, from my perspective, there's a responsibility for the tribes to communicate amongst themselves to try to help resolve some of these issues and not leave the state in the middle on some of these. Because if we're the ones trying to sit here and try to understand where the treaty right preempts state law with a relative degree of certainty, and that comes with evidence that isn't as always that's as black and white as one would like. We have set our threshold, and I have admittedly said fairly low. Is it's more of a civil law rather than a criminal law? Is it reasonable? Is there a preponderance of the evidence to suggest that if a particular member of a tribe was hunting in a particular area, that they would be hunting there pursuant to their treaty right? Or conversely, if they weren't, then they would be susceptible to the enforcement of state laws. This is a tough issue for us, and I'm going to be having additional discussions with the representatives from these three tribes about where do we go from here. We also have, I had a government-to-government meeting with the Skokomish tribe on this, on hunting issues, just this week. And we talked about, because within the ceded area, a lot of times where you've got multiple tribes within a particular ceded area, they have intertribal agreements as to what portions of that ceded area a particular tribe will hunt or not. And so there's those pieces too. So we got to figure out a way to work through this, because what we're doing right now isn't a path for success. And we're going to, as I say, we're committed to work with the tribes on this. We're committed to come and meet with Quileute on a government-to-government basis, continuing those conversations. So that's my attempt to kind of summarize where this issue is from the department's perspective.
And there was one point that came to my attention, too, that I might as well mention. I understand that some of the heartburn is related to the fact that the Quileute tribe was not able to see the evidence that was presented by the Point No Point tribes.
Yes, that's correct.
You weren't invited into the meeting, so there wasn't the kind of transparency that you would like.
Right.
Before we made our call in terms of where we're going to deploy our enforcement effort. I think just looking at the history of the Bolt decision and subsequent case law, the tribes have done a marvelous job in training us all to respect treaty rights, to respect the government-to-government co-management relationship, to respect tribal sovereignty. So we've all got that. And what you're seeing in some ways is an effect of that, that we have to respect that kind of a relationship with each and every tribe we deal with. And when they make a call to bring us evidence that is not in writing, that is just oral in nature, and we make our judgment based on that, you can see that really as a signal, as an illustration that we're respecting the co-management relationship with that tribe, with those tribes. So we're caught in the middle here. We've got to respect each and every tribal relationship that we have. But maybe, I just wondered, can we require this evidence to be in writing so that it can be shared? I don't know that we can insist that each potentially affected tribe be part of the government-to-government negotiations, but we could look at that. I mean, I think that that's
right.
Reasonable, just personally.
Certainly. I think one of the bigger concerns is that this process has been going on for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. There was ample time to give us a call that there was information that could lead to this. When we found out about it, it was in the field. And in the field, the law enforcement officers from the state were unaware of this agreement. So you folks got some secrecy issues that are going on that have to be turned over and provided to at least the party that may be affected by it. We have no idea that this was in the works, that it was close to being implemented. We were under the understanding that, you know, the map that the state had sent us back in 2000, the ceded area map, was something that they were going to stand behind. But it turns out that that's not true. And it turns out that there was a lot of dialogue going on. And we're not just waiting for somebody to show up in the territory. We've done our homework as well. So we're more than willing to share what we know, but it isn't going to, definitely, I don't see that leading to supporting some of the assertions as far as we can tell. Now, we met with the Lower Elwes before. They showed us the information, and we reviewed it, and we had our anthropologists take a look at it. There is no evidence that supports this action. So now we're going like, okay, why are we doing this? Why are we engaged in this? Why are we being left out? Well, obviously, people just don't want to have us show them where it doesn't exist, you know. But we've got to get to that point sooner or later, and we're seeing a large increase in effort take place because this last weekend with the regulations for the new tribes was that they could either take 4 deer and an elk, or they could take 6 deer. Well, we're down to limiting ourselves when we used to be able to take 2 deer down to 1 because of conservation. So this agreement doesn't do what it says it's going to do. And one, it's not shared. So we're bringing this awareness to you folks so that you can help us get down to the nuts and bolts. We've left some packets with you so you can see some of the correspondence and the communications. I am willing to have conversations with each and every one of you about the details. We'll welcome you out to La Push. We'll have a discussion. We want to solve this too, and for fairness. You know, it's not just about taking. It's about how to live in this world together. So we're just raising this up. It's very important to us. Our whole council is here. It's our attempt to just make sure that everybody is aware, and we're going to take steps to try to make more people aware about what's going on here because it's not right. It was handled wrong.
Well, I think you've done an excellent job bringing it to our attention. So I hope you feel the trip down here has been worthwhile. It's a long trip. So I just wanted to thank you for doing that and coming to us in such an organized, professional manner. So I'm going to ask our executive committee to work with me and see what we can do, see what our options might be, so you'll be hearing from us.
Well, we appreciate that. Like I said, you know, it's my opinion, they don't belong there at this point in time. You know, I think with the factor that they're hunting in our area, our ceded area, you know, we have given them documents that says they don't belong there. Provide your anthropological evidence to us. They haven't done that. They provided it to you folks. And if it's an oral agreement that they told you, what's going to happen next if somebody else says, well, we used to hunt there too? Are they going to give it that opportunity to come hunt in our area? It makes it difficult for us to figure out what's going on when we have to hear from a law enforcement officer in the field that says, you know, I wasn't aware of this. I wasn't aware that these guys could come in here and hunt. And now they don't have no ability to cite anybody in there because you've allowed the line to go down to our area. So now the enforcement side of it is there's nothing they can do because it's been allowed. And so we have no recourse on anything we can do against these individuals that are hunting in our area, taking our elk, our deer, and whatever else they have, you know, tags for. It's really a concern for us.
Okay.
So thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, we've got several more people who've signed up for testimony. John Rosapepe and Sean Cosgrove, please come forward. Mr. Rosapepe.
Thank you. Should I go ahead?
Yes.
Good morning, Chairman Wecker and rest of the members of the commission. I'm testifying concerning the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife's proposal to include gray wolves in the upcoming 2015-2021 game management plan. Defenders opposes including a section about wolves in the upcoming game management plan. With approximately 75 gray wolves in the state, considerations of the management of gray wolves as a game species are premature. The gray wolf remains state and federally listed as an endangered species and should be managed as such until the best available science indicates otherwise and the proper legal and administrative changes are made to the status of the species. Including a section of wolves in the game management plan supposes that the state recovery goals will be met during the period of 2015 through 2001, that the commission will have reclassified wolves as game species, and that proposals to hunt wolves would have gone through a public process with the Fish and Wildlife Commission. The Washington Department Fish and Wildlife staff claims made at the December Wolf Advisory Group that the recovery objectives for wolves will likely be met during the 2015-2021 are premature and without scientific merit. Wolves appeared in the North Cascades region in 2008, and 6 years later are nowhere near the recovery goals for delisting in the region. There are currently zero packs or successful breeding pairs in the Southern Cascades and Northwest Coast regions. Further, including a section on wolves at this time, including a statement on the principle of hunting wolves as proposed by Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife staff at the December WAG meeting, makes several suppositions that run against the wolf conservation and management plan. When the recovery goals are met and delisting occurs, there are several management issues that will still need to be decided upon. These decisions have not been made yet, and including wolves in the game management plan is pre-decisional and premature at this time. Also, the 2015-2001 game management plan questionnaire includes wolf depredations on livestock and pets, as well as wolf livestock conflict management. These are not topics that should be included in the game management plan, as neither wolves, pets, or livestock are considered game. Wolf-livestock conflict management issues are already being addressed in other forums, including the Wolf Conservation Management Plan. Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife currently has a proposal that dealing with the Washington Administrative Code and Protocol that addresses wolf-livestock conflicts. I urge you to be judicious in your assumption that the gray wolf will be recovered to the extent that Washington could designate it a game species and implement a hunting season within the next 6 years. Defenders of Wildlife is opposed to the inclusion of the gray wolf in any game management plan until wolves are delisted, recovered, and thriving in Washington. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Bruce Fierke, you'd come forward, please. Mr. Cosgrove.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Sean Cosgrove. I'm an environmental science scientist by degree, and my issue today is the dismissiveness of WDFW and some of the other regulatory agencies when it comes to specifically suction dredging and mining in itself. My subject was brought on by a conversation I had about environmental impact studies that have been done, but not necessarily publicized or referenced a lot. My colleagues asked that why don't they just do a nice big multi-agency collaborated environmental impact study and get to the bottom of what suction dredge does and does not do. And they have been. Unfortunately, that most of the rule changes that have been done do not reference. The most recent one was California impact study down there as far as suction dredging. And the study, multi-collaborated again, was shown that suction dredging had no significant impact. I know that falls on deaf ears nowadays, but they decided to dismiss those findings and go with their own management decisions. And I see some of that happening here. When there is impact studies done, they will dismiss those and also dismiss best management practices. We've seen here, especially with the last Golden Fish book done, the recommendations and the science we put forward was dismissed quite easily without even rebuttals, or just dismissed. And so with those, the science behind it being dismissed and the best management practice being dismissed, I'd like to know that if the decisions are being made by political. I mean, I think that would be the only option available, and it's kind of a concern. From what I see, I apologize for not speaking very well, but I think that should do it.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Fierke. Oh, let me call Tony Wagman. Wait, Wakeman. All right, Mr. Fierke.
What does it take to decimate a stream as far as fish goes? And obviously, many of you are experts in that arena. Two observations I want to relate. Years ago, I was dredging up on Piscataquis Creek in the Central Cascades. There were several other dredgers up there. This was years ago, and that stream was open year-round for that kind of activity. There was also fishermen on the same stream fishing amongst us and downstream from me, and I observed them catching many fish. Okay? Another observation that I made was this summer. I went up to Alaska, and I was working in a little valley that had Cache Creek. This entire valley was scraped clean with a bucket line dredge. The stream was diverted back and forth and mixed up with the rest of the stream sediments. Yet in the month of August, there was salmon, natural spawn salmon that were huge, 30 and 40 pounders that I observed going up there, lots of them. That dredge did not decimate that stream as far as fish life went. I submit that suction dredging does not decimate streams as far as fish life goes.
Thank you. Bert Swift, would you come forward, please? How do you pronounce your last name? Wageman?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Good morning, thank you. Mine is a different topic. It's upland birds. Come to find out that the bird population has gone down throughout the whole state, wild birds, as well. And coming to find out that we're not raising our birds in Washington anymore, we're buying from Idaho. I don't understand that. I think it would be nice to bring that back into Washington and, keep our money here. And out there at Sunnyside Release Site, I've been working dogs and hunting for quite a while. And they have a lot of property, on-site water, everything to create a pen so we can actually buy birds a younger age, bring them in, raise them, then they can distribute out throughout Yakima area. And I got talking to the Yakima Nation. They're realizing also that their bird population has gone down, and they're going to start looking towards restocking their own, back to more wild birds, pheasant and quail. And I got a buddy who used to hunt over in out of state. I think it might have been, give me a second, one moment, please. Out of state in I thought I was going to remember, so. Wyoming. I guess they have a really, really good upland project, and one of the things that they apparently do is they will do like a raffle. Cost $10-$15 per person, whoever wants to do it, and they'll throw out X amount of birds for X amount of days. That will bring more money into Washington for upland. But I would like to actually see us bring the bring our work back to us, so we can get population to go back up. It's kind of disheartening too for a dog who's out there working hard for us, and there's nothing there. That then also changing the release site days and or times. Like you'd set hours from 8 to 4. So when the upland management goes out there and drops birds, it's safer on them. Everybody who's out there hunting, just set lines. It's 8 o'clock, 4 o'clock, get off the property. Everything's safer than I've heard of people shooting birds as soon as they come in. The locals know when they come in. They go in and just wipe the place out in 2 days. It cost me, a lot of money to drive over east to go work my dog. It's like $100+ go to their motel, all that, whatever. And it would just be nice to see some changes.
Okay. Thank you.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Swift.
I'm a miner in the state of Washington. I've played with it for approximately 30 years now. Brought my two sons into it. We've had a lot of fun out there in the woods. And I would like to say that the comments made by the other people ahead of me come directly to the point, is that this commission is not listening to us, and they have used flawed information. And I would invite any one of you to come out with us or any of the clubs in this state and join us this summer and watch what we do, learn something. You're not going to learn anything until you get your hands wet and dirty. And the definition of placer mining is just hard work, guys. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. That concludes the open public input item in the morning agenda.